Hey, welcome back, everybody, to the Benos Podcast. And today's guest on the episode number 26 is Bastian Nachbar. Boki, as we all know, is the managing director of the EuroLeague Players Association. But besides the work that he does currently with them, we also talked about his experience as a player. Also, the project he used to have as a podcaster, which was interesting to listen to. But mostly we talked about the relationship between players and coaches, assistant coaches, the expectations he has from assistant coaches, and the experiences he had with different styles of coaching. So listen in if you want to hear a player's perspective on all these little nuances that exist within the basketball world, or a locker room rather. It's very interesting to hear a player of this magnitude, of what he thinks, what a player expects from coaches, and especially assistant coaches. So we talked about that. We talked about also the current job that he has, as I mentioned, as the managing director of the Players Association, of the achievements they've had so far and the plans they have in the future, as well as the importance of young players within the business, what they can expect, and the work they can do to going forward to balance the act between teams and players' expectations. Please listen in. Please give us a 5-star review on Spotify. Please rate us on Apple. Subscribe to the podcast. Subscribe to the YouTube channel. We need more likes, more shares. Share it on Twitter. We need to bring this bad boy up. So please continue listening. Enjoy this episode and hear or talk to you and see you soon. Bye. And we are recording. Zoom told me we are recording. Boki, welcome. We just met in Belgrade, and poof, here you are on my podcast. That's how quick it goes. Thanks for coming.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's we had a quick introduction, and our conversation was flowing well, and I thought that it would be a good opportunity to talk to you about your experiences, not only what you do now, which we'll get to, but also as a player on various levels in various leagues. So I hope you're ready for my endeavor.
I hope so.
Before we start, I prepare four quarters for you. I prepare for most of the players four quarters and coaches as well. But before we start, you used to have a podcast as well. You had something that, like, you told me about in Slovenia.
Yeah, we did a podcast for I think about 7 or 8 years in a row, but it wasn't strictly a basketball podcast. Even though we did have basketball guests, and it was different topics, different guests. You know, we covered everything, like, you know, from sports to music to history to, you know, astrophysics to just whatever we felt at the time that was interesting to us, because it was myself and another co-host, and then we added another of our friends. So it was actually myself as an athlete, and the co-host was a former basketball player, never played professionally, but he works at the radio, so yeah, he's a radio guy. And then the third guy was a stand-up comedian. So we had a really interesting combo, you know, and yeah, we spoke about basketball as well, and we had, you know, a lot of Slovenian basketball players as guests, but also NBA players. And I know that JJ Redick was our guest, and Jim Jackson was our guest, and you know, we had still a long list of players that we wanted to talk to, but at some point it became just too much, especially with what I do now. It became, the scheduling wise, it didn't work anymore. So but, you know, I'm a huge fan of podcasts myself, you know, and was one of the first that did it in Slovenia, to be honest, you know, the pioneer.
Nice.
You know, so,
yeah. Are they still going, or is that just broken up?
We might still continue. You know, we're taking a break, and you know, a friend of mine who was also running, he got his second child not so long ago. So, you know, we all overwhelmed now with the scheduling and the family, you know, and everything else. But we still might do it, maybe not as regularly, because we did like every 2 weeks for years, you know. Yeah. But we might do more of it, like specials, you know, like a special session, and especially live events, which we did also in Slovenia and attracted a lot of audience. So
nice.
Maybe we'll focus on that in the future and still come back maybe, you know, a couple times a year and do a live event, you know.
So it wasn't in Slovenian and English. You were switching back and forth depending on the guests?
Depending on the guests, we would do one or the other. And mostly we focused on Slovenian audience. We never were really trying to push international podcast. But yeah, we had, you know, English speaking guests as well. Probably I would say maybe one quarter of them were English speaking at least.
Yeah.
And it was just as accepted just as well. I mean, young people in Slovenia speak English, so it was, we didn't notice any difference in the number of lists, downloads and, you know, between one and the other. Actually, probably more in English than Slovenian.
Wow. Yeah, man, it's good. Like, you have a different perspectives on the podcast from different avenues of life.
Yeah,
and,
yeah, yeah.
And then you get a different input from each of them. And if you with your experiences, the stand-up comedian, and I'm sure it was very entertaining to say the least.
It was, because we went from very serious topics, you know. I'll give you an example. Like, Dan Carlin was our guest, you know.
Really?
Yeah. Like,
wow.
The historian.
Yeah.
Wim Hof was our guest, you know, the Wim Hof method.
Yeah.
You know, that has this rehealing method.
Breathing
method in ice or in cold water. So we would do like serious topics, and then we would have a stand-up comedian guest, and we would have some shows that we were laughing so much that we couldn't stop laughing. So because it wasn't live, a lot of times we would pre-record, we had to like cut down times when you were like laughing, because it would be like 3 minutes of just crying, laughing. So our guy had to like make it, you know, user-friendly, let's say.
Tighter,
you know?
How long were the episodes?
About 45 minutes to an hour. We tried to keep it short, and, you know, it's always like you're trying to satisfy different views of listeners. You have people who want shorter episodes, you have people who want things to be dragged out. So we kind of kept it 45 minutes to an hour, which when we started doing podcasts was a lot for people who didn't know podcasts. You know, people are used to these radio interviews, 5 minutes, boom, boom, boom. And then when we had a guest, we took our time and we went deep into the topics, and going, you know, an hour and 15 conversation at first was like, people were like, man, they're so long. But then they started seeing the difference between a, let's call it a radio interview and a podcast, where usually it's like you're dictated by the, you know, by the time and by the sponsorships or whatever, and you got a commercial breaks and all that, or TV, for example, where, you know, when you do your own, let's call it quote unquote private podcast, you're the boss.
Yeah.
And you can drag it out as much as you want, and you can go as deep as you want in the topics, and people started to catch up on that and appreciate it more. And I think that's one of the reasons why the podcasts are so popular around the world. It's the new way of communicating through internet.
Yeah, that's the long form podcast has more substance, because you can just go in any avenue you want and you can dive deep. I mean, we talked about it. It's like Joe Rogan style is just an other extreme. And that's what, like, I started off, like, cause I was traveling a lot by myself, and I started listening to Joe Rogan and Tim Ferriss for the first ones when I started this scouting job. And then you start thinking, and just, it's like, looks like 3 hours long, but it just, you don't have to listen to it at once. You listen to like an hour and a half, and then just keeps going. And it doesn't mean you dive into it, but you get a lot of ideas from it. You get a lot of information from it. True. And that's why that was the inspiration for me to do it as well, because in this basketball avenue that we both know has so many nuances to it, and having the opportunity to talk to different perspectives, people with different perspectives as well, gives a lot of substance to this podcast. And that's all.
And especially if you produce quality content, then it's going to happen to you soon. It happened to us also. I have to fortunately say that people started then saying it's too short. Same people that would at the beginning say, well, it's kind of long and blah, blah. But at a time when they get the idea behind why they're longer and all that, people started asking for longer podcasts. So we intentionally kept it under 60 minutes just so we could have people wanting more. We kind of like that, you know, so that's what we did.
Yeah, that's like the podcast ideas in the U.S., it's, you know, they're in traffic for an hour. So for them, it's quite easy to listen to a podcast. And then an hour back to home or whatever, you already have 2 hours in your pocket. So it's a little bit different. It's culture-wise, it's more adaptable in the States, and that's why it's bigger. But in Europe, it's catching on, and it's been probably now, like, it's saturated. The market is saturated from both directions. It's just like very, you have to have a very niche podcast to really gain the attention.
I think it's very difficult to come up with something completely new, right? I mean, you know, 10 years ago or 9 years ago in 2013 when we started, it was easy, because whatever we did, it was like, wow, we have a national team player all of a sudden that is talking to us through podcasting, just blah, blah, blah. Because like I said, people were just used to this interviews. And back then, I kind of felt like whatever we did, and as long as it would be interesting, but whatever topic we discussed, it would catch on. Now, I think, like you said, it's so saturated already. There's so many podcasts. There's good ones, great ones. There's a lot of also bad content out there.
Yeah.
So people are kind of really picky on what to choose and what they listen, you know?
And it's also, you know, it depends what you want to get out of it. And then when people listen, you talk, it seems like you said on the radio, unreachable person that's like so distant. And then when you listen to it on the podcast, it's like, man, I get to know Bastian. I get to know Joe. Like I listened to Joe Rogan's probably like, not exaggerating, 1,000 episodes or more, probably more. Yeah. And he says it himself, if you listen to me constantly, you probably know me as well, probably not as well as my wife, but just as close as my friends, because you can't fake it. You are who you are at that point.
It's true. And I also started with Joe Rogan. Like he was probably not the first podcast, but for sure one of the first, I'll say like this, it was the first regular podcast that I listened to. So I maybe checked some other ones when this all was coming out in 2009, 2010. But Joe Rogan was the first one that I then listened carefully, and I still listen today. Not all episodes. I used to back in the day. I used to listen to all of them. Now I'm kind of selecting depending on the guest that he has. You know, I kind of stay away from stand-up comedians and sometimes stay away from the MMA stuff that he does, even though I am an MMA fan myself, and I almost watched MMA from UFC from like the beginning onwards. But I prefer when he has a politically minded or socially minded like guess that's or you know something has to do with astrophysics and things like that that's
so I me too confused. Yeah me too sometimes with the comedians they get so drunk that it's hard to listen
it's too much. It's too much. I'm like I don't need to go there, you know, you guys have fun, and then whenever you got a different guest I'll check it out.
Me too I'm the same, but we're not gonna get drunk today. We're gonna talk a little bit about your— let's start with your player experience, of course, NBA experience, and just to dive specifically about some processes and some, because we have a lot of coaches, we have a lot of sports directors and managers listening. What was the process back then for you preparing for the draft? Like the specific, I know like the workouts are very structured, but did you have like a plan with your agent at the time that you're going to go through and have a selective workouts? And what was the idea behind the preparation?
Yeah, I did have a— or we did have a plan, even though it was a very short plan, because I was playing in Italy at the time in Benetton Treviso, and we went all the way. We won the Italian championship, so we went, you know, almost until I want to say 20th of June or something like this, maybe 15th, 20th of June. And you know, draft is, or at least back then, was end of June, right?
So yep.
So I maybe had between the last game in Italian league and between the draft was maybe 10 days, maybe. So I remember that as soon as we won the Italian championship, and luckily we won 3-0 in the finals against Fortitudo, I was on the plane, I think 2 days later, or maybe even the next day, I was already flying to the States. And there I just had a couple of days in Washington, is where my agent at the time was residing. So I stayed there maybe for 3-4 days just to get, you know, the time difference and everything acclimated, was working out a little bit, and then I went 4 workouts in 4 days. So I did, you know, Washington Wizards, Charlotte Hornets, Indiana Pacers, and Houston Rockets. So I did 4 workouts and then flew right back to New York for the draft. So it was a very quick, you know, very quick period.
Turnaround
that I had to go through. It wasn't like a long schedule, 3-4 week, a month long tour that some players do. So I only went to the teams that were picking around the time that I was supposed to be picked, like mid first round. And that was it, you know, and there was not much time for more. And, you know, I think that also there wasn't much need, because I think, you know, playing already and getting a lot of playing time in my last year before NBA helped me to get noticed. And I think the scouts saw a lot of my game already. So it wasn't like I was not like a secret or something like this, you know.
Yeah, so, but you guys selected the workout specifically for the range. And that was like, that was pre-selected on that.
Washington had, I believe, 11, if I'm not mistaken. I think Indiana had 13 or 14, and Houston had 15. But I know that in Houston, when I was working out there, a bunch of other scouts came also in from other teams, because Houston allowed them to. It was kind of like an agreement that they made. So even though it was a Houston Rocket workout, there were other GMs also present. And Charlotte Hornets, I don't think they were even like in that range. I don't think they were didn't even have the first round, but they wanted to see me live because they were thinking about drafting or training into the draft. And they wanted, for some reason, they wanted to see me live. And I had a horrible workout with the Hornets. I remember that was actually the first one I had. So from Washington, I flew to Charlotte and did it there and then back to Washington. And that was, It was just me and another player that I cannot remember the name. He was not drafted after, but we had like a full court one-on-one drill. And he was a guard and I was a forward. So going against like a physical guard, like full court one-on-one, I was dying in practice. I looked so bad, I think. I was like, I'm not going to get picked, you know. But then luckily in other workouts, it was not like this, you know, full court one-on-one. It was more of 2-on-2, 3-on-3 drills, you know, shooting drills, stuff like that. And that suited me better instead of going against one-on-one against full court against the guard, you know.
Against the guard, yeah. Was Houston your best workout?
What'd you say? Probably. I mean, Houston, I think, was kind of determined already. They're going to take me if I'm still going to be available. That's at least was the mindset of everybody me coming in. They even said that to us when we were there. Even though that's, you never know what happens in the draft, especially like after the lottery. It's you know, or even in lottery, but especially like, you know, the deeper you go in the draft, the more surprises there can be. So, but they said if I'm going to be on the board, they'll take me. They said they were really honest. They said the only player they would take in front of me is Caron Butler if he would still be available, and then he got picked, I think, number 10 by Miami, I think. But they were really honest, and they said, yeah, we've been, you know, watching your season. It's true that they sent scouts to Treviso. Rui Tomjanovic was there after they finished their season, so he watched me live. So they showed the most interest. So the workout I had was good, and you know, everything I did was good. I think I had a really good shooting practice also with them. You know, part of it we dedicated only to shooting, like just different shooting drills. Mm-hmm. Part of it was like 1-on-1, 2-on-2, 3-on-3. There were a bunch of other players there. But I felt really comfortable, you know, in that workout, because also the way they accepted me and the way they treated me there, you know, it wasn't as distant, as cold as some other teams maybe. Look, you're just one of the guys. It was kind of like a welcome already, which helped. Yeah.
Yeah. You felt at ease. You felt welcome, and you kind of give you a little bit, took some, not pressure, I would say, but just a little bit of tension.
Yeah. I was much more relaxed than with other workouts, because in Washington Wizards workout, Michael Jordan was working me out. So, and it's not a joke. He was there. He was running the practice pretty much. I did practice together with Jerry Jeffries. It was me and Jerry Jeffries. Uh-huh. So Jerry Jeffries got picked by Washington Wizards later, and we knew he's going to probably get picked by them. They were really high on him. So it was me and him and a couple of other guys. Jerzy Welsh was there also, and I think maybe 2-3 more guys. But Michael Jordan was running the practice. He was basically showing us some drills and correcting us and stuff. And so that was a high-pressure situation. You know?
Definitely. If any, that's definitely some eyes on you.
Yeah.
So the first year, tell me what usually, not necessarily you, but with your experience also, and maybe you saw some other rookies struggle with the most as a rookie. Like what's the most common struggle that a rookie has coming to the NBA?
You know, obviously it depends of the type of the player. You know, for me, I can speak from my experience, and maybe what I've seen with the others was mostly getting used to the physicality of the game at that time. I was fairly skinny and let's say underdeveloped for an NBA game. So I needed to get stronger and more physical, that's for sure. And the second thing that I was kind of was working in my disadvantage a little bit, even though I wanted to go to Houston, was because I was basically the second first round pick for them. Yao Ming was obviously the first choice and number one pick, and all the focus was on him. So I was really treated more as a second rounder. They even said that I'm their first round pick for next year, because Houston didn't have a first rounder the next year. They traded it away even before this draft. So I had to be patient, and that wasn't easy. You know, a year ago I was playing in Benetton, Treviso, went to the EuroLeague Final Four, won Italian championship, and had a big role. And then you go into NBA, and all of a sudden you're sitting on the bench and not even getting in games. So that was difficult. So getting more physical and understanding the NBA game better, which back then suited me not as much as I think it would later in my career, and especially now, because it was much more physical, much more one-on-one, post-up, mid-range, like a banging kind of basketball. And that was the challenge that I had to you know, go through and understand the game better and just be physical enough to be able to get minutes.
How long did it take you to really feel like you are there? Like this, what, like a whole 2 seasons, 1 season?
Yeah, well, definitely not in the first season, because I also didn't play much. So the minutes I would get here and there, like 3 minutes in this game and then nothing for 2 weeks and 5 minutes in that game, that didn't count as anything. I didn't get any feel from that, you know. Yeah. And in practice, you know how it is in the NBA. Once the season really gets going, there's no real practice anymore. So I use that to you know just get better at you know different things you know technically and get stronger. So I would say second year was the one that I started feeling more at home and more comfortable. You know, but again, another unfortunate thing is that I got drafted by Rudy Tomjanovic and his coaching staff. And after my first season, because of his illness, he stepped down. So Jeff Van Gundy and the whole new coaching staff comes in that didn't really know me that well, or didn't probably need me or want me in the team in the first place, because they had a completely different philosophy.
Yeah.
So I had to go from this player who liked to play an open game and fast game that, you know, kind of fit with Steve Francis and those guys, Yao Ming, Coutinho, Mobley, that we had on the team. That was the idea behind it. I had to change into this 3-and-D kind of guy, you know, which was not what I did, you know. I mean, threes, yes, but to be like a stagnant player that would just basically stay in the corner and play this New York Knicks 90s type of basketball, which what we tried to do. It didn't really suit me well, but I had to do my best to get minutes, and I did, and I played, and you know, I had a much big, as the season went on, got a bigger and bigger role, and then played a lot in the playoffs. But then in my third year, I got traded away, which was a really important thing for me to happen, to go to Hornets and start playing really big minutes, and you know, being basically the sixth man for you know the year and a half that I was there.
Right. Then that was my like last NBA question I wanted to dig into was, what was the talk to me about the experience going through receiving the message that you got traded? Was that something that was like already kind of in the talks that you kind of anticipated, or and how did it hit you? Like, you know,
I got traded twice. So the first time I got traded is I was asking for a trade for a while, my third season, because the Houston Rockets did not pick up my fourth year option. And I kind of expected it because I didn't have a very big role, and I didn't fit in the system that they tried to do. So I knew that I don't fit. I tried to get traded earlier so I would play somewhere and my option would be picked, but it didn't happen. So going into my third season and not having, as soon as my option wasn't picked, we asked to be traded right away. You know, I asked, you know, and we had a good relation. It wasn't like I was mad at anybody. I just said, I really want to go somewhere where I can play, because if I go 3 years without actually having a bigger role, I'm probably not going to sign my next contract. Like I'll go back to Europe. So I did get traded just around the Christmas time, and you know, Jeff Van Gundy called me and he said, "Hey, you know, we tried to get away, you know, to a different team, and we found a team for you. They traded me for David Wesley, who was an experienced player and the guy that could, you know, do a lot more for that team, and what they were trying to achieve at the time. And I was totally fine with it. So I went to the Hornets. Back then it was New Orleans Hornets. Mm-hmm. And I started playing right away, like 20, 25 minutes. You know, the team was not having a great record, and it was just about giving young players a chance to play. So that's what I needed, and that's what I got. But the second time I was traded from the Hornets to the Nets, it was completely unexpected. Well, it was unexpected because I re-signed with the Hornets for 3 years, and I was very comfortable and was starting some of the games, coming off the bench the other games. But then we had a couple of incidents that happened that we had, David West was injured, Birdman, Chris Anderson was injured, Jackson Roman broke his hand, and we had another big guy that was also on the injured list. So we were without a center going into the trade deadline. So we knew there's going to be a trade. And on the trade deadline day, there was no trade. So once I got home and I turned on the TV, like in the afternoon, I saw in the ESPN news that I got traded to the Nets. And I called my agent. I said, "Did I just get traded?" And he's like, "I don't know nothing about it." So it had to just happen. It was like a last minute deal that they made. That's why it was so unexpected, because I didn't think I was going to get traded, even though it can happen at any moment.
Yeah.
But I got traded to the Nets, and I always say it was the best thing that could happen to me, because I got to play with some of the, you know, greatest players, and with Jason Kidd, and played a lot, and we went deep into the playoffs and just had a lot of fun over there. My best years were with the Nets.
Yeah, what an experience that is, man. I can't imagine. It's a different world for many people. That's not hard to understand when you get, you know, just from one team to another. You play you and you see these guys now performing really well and different roles in the NBA. So it's definitely a blessing also when you get traded to a team like that, and you learn a lot, but you also get to hang out and form these relationships for the future.
Yeah, it's true. And the trades can be, you never know until you play it out. I mean, when I got traded to the Nets, first of all, I was pissed off. I thought I was not going to play, and I didn't play right away when I got there. But somehow I fit into this system that they had, you know, and wings running, you know, athletic team, you know, a three-point shooting team, and I kind of fit, and it was great. I mean, having Vince Carter and Richard Jefferson, but especially Vince Carter being double-teamed in regular basis was awesome for me. Like, I had a guy that was drawing attention, and all the kickouts that were coming out were, like, golden for me. Like, I was enjoying that role so much, you know?
Yeah, just be ready to shoot.
For sure. That I had to do that. The players that didn't shoot didn't fit in that system. It was that system, that simple.
So let me ask you about then when you later on 6 years in the NBA, I believe you were, yeah. you went back to Europe. What was the did you have adaptation problems, or did you fit in right away? You felt like you could jump in and go balls out and feel like you feel like you belong to Europe again, and you know yourself better? Or was there like an adaptation period where you're trying to figure out who you are in a different country, different system, different style of play?
Yeah, I was lucky because David Blatt was the coach in Moscow when I went there. So culturally, yes. I mean, I knew that it was going to be much different, obviously. You know, but the team was, at that time when I went to Moscow, you know, it was really professional and highly organized. You know, Dynamo Moscow at that time was aiming really high and had, let's say, the budget and the personnel to chase that. And by personnel, I mean players also. We had basically a EuroLeague team playing in EuroCup, you know, and yeah. we had a great season up until the crisis started of 2008, 2009. And that's when Dynamo Moscow overnight started shutting down. I mean, he ended up playing the season, but players started leaving because financially the team was not able to hold up. So that was unfortunate because I signed a three-year agreement there. And with David Blatt, we had this agreement that we'll bring the team back to EuroLeague and build on that. And I was willing to stay there long-term just because the project itself was so well, let's say, you know, so well established and so well put down on paper, but unfortunately it didn't happen that way. It took me a little bit. It took me a couple of months to really get back into this Euro style of play. But after that, I kind of took off and had a great Euro Cup and you know, the VTB or the Russian League, you know, season. The problem was once, you know, February, March came by and players started leaving, we just were not the same team anymore. And then it even more fell everything on my shoulders and the guys that were there. We had Darius Lavrinovic and Yevtokas was there also, Robertas, and we were one of the last guys that stayed there. That wasn't fun then anymore. You know, it didn't make sense to stick around in a team that is basically falling apart, or a club that is falling apart. And most of us, I think all of us, actually foreigners, left after that one season.
Mm. Let's talk about a little bit about the coaching now, like from the player's perspective that you experience on the NBA level versus European level. Obviously David Blatt has a completely different mindset than the, let's call it, like the average European coach, because he thinks differently. I know him, and I know how he really expresses himself and also reaches players. But in your experience from the NBA, and maybe it's more so assistant coaches outside of the game, like in between practices, the communication level of that you experience in Europe versus America of how they interact with players.
Yeah, I you know, when I was playing in Italy in Benetton, my coach was Mike D'Antoni. Mm-hmm. You know, he was a coach back then before he became big in the NBA. So I kind of really always felt comfortable with American style of coaching, the communication that coaches have and certain freedom that they give to players and stuff like that. Still strict and still structured, but much different than, you know, especially like the Yugoslavian old school of basketball, which I also had coaches, and under some coaches I performed really well. But I felt more at home with American style of coaching, especially then in the NBA and you know, my time with New Jersey Nets with Lawrence Frank. And then the reason why I came back to Europe, or one of the reasons, was because I went to play for David Blatt. Like, otherwise, I don't think if me and him were not talking a lot over that summer and him explaining me how he sees basketball and what he tries to do as far as my role would be, I don't think the team would be able to convince me, even though the contract was financially was big at that time. So I always felt that I fit better with those coaches who have that kind of background. Even when I was in Bamberg playing in Germany, like Chris Fleming was the coach and I had a good run there, you know? Mm-hmm. So I think that for me, and I think for many players, is very important the communication that the coach brings to the table and the upfront and honest that he is with you. I never liked coaching or coaches that tell you one thing just to satisfy you for that moment, but then do things differently, you know? And I like the positivity that American coaches bring to the table, you know, not so much the criticism and the negative things that they expose, but also trying to not hype you up, but trying to tell you and show you what you're capable of and building on that. And that always helped me as a player.
It's fair to say that American style of coaching is a confidence style of coaching. Like it really encourages you to be who you are as a player, and it gives you a little bit of a more confident demeanor. And if you can't perform as the most confident possibility with the most freedom that you can have, then you're probably not made for that level, right? Like, I mean, there's the other way, like you said, the old school mentality of getting the best out of you in regards to pushing you to the limit of like emotional frustration to the max. And if you can't handle that, then you can handle all the frustration that comes during the game. But it's a different approach, completely different. And I think that more players are made for the confident style of coaching instead of the hypercritical style of coaching, especially today.
Yeah. I think that has changed a little bit. I think back in the day, you know, especially coming from Europe or coming from the, you know, ex-Yugoslavian countries, like it was normal that the coaches would be really tough on you. And yeah. I don't like the word to say negative, but they would really, when you made a mistake, they made sure that the whole world knows about you made a mistake, you know, like, and you had to build on that. You had to get through that and you became mentally stronger and stuff like that. So there's benefits in that as well. Whereas, you know, like we said, the more of an American style of coaching was more about building confidence. And even if you make a mistake, like work through it, you can do this, you got this. So I'm not saying one is better than others, because otherwise, if one would be clearly better, then everybody would coach in a certain way. I think for coaches, it's more important to understand what kind of players they have and then, you know, adjust their coaching a little bit, or especially the communication towards what kind of players do you have. Do you have a player that needs to be told that he's doing a bad job and it's not working for him to be more motivated and to get out of that slump? Or if a coach if a player is making mistakes and you know that his confidence is fragile, it's better not to get too hard on him, because then you lose him even more. So I think that's something that some coaches at times forget. Players, we're different. The mentalities are different. The confidence levels are different. The reactions to certain situations, we react differently. So that's what I miss sometimes with coaches who would, yes, treat everybody equally. Of course, that's important. But individual communication, I thought it had to be sometimes the coaches that we knew how to adjust person to person, I thought are considered better coaches.
Yeah, there's several things. There can be a double standard within the team concept when you talk to the team. Yes, the different roles, and Andrea talked about it too, Junkieri, like there's different roles have different expectations. So you can't hold the star hold a role player to the same standard as the star. But in general, the principle should be the same for everybody. But whenever you have individual communication, one-on-one, like you said, the reaching somebody is completely different from person to person. So you have to have this player, this feel for the person, feel for the individual that's how you get the best out of them. But also on top of that, if I want to add one more thing, not only do you have to know who you have as a player, what personality you have, but also who you are as a coach, who you are as a person, because the players look through your identity in a heartbeat. If you're trying to be somebody else, and you're trying to pretend to be this hard-nosed coach, and then all of a sudden you become wishy-washy, you slip up. Because if you're a hard-nosed coach, you have to be hard-nosed every single practice, every single hour, every single moment. You can't let anything slip. You start slipping here and there, the player is going to look through it, and then you're just going to, your identity starts crumbling. So I think it's more important for coaches, before they know who the players are, who they are, mm-hmm. and to portray themselves as an authentic coach. Basically.
Very good. I think you said one important word at the end, authentic. You know, I think the coaches need to understand who they are and what kind of coaching style they have and what they bring to the table. You know, faking something, I think players sooner or later are gonna see that, and that doesn't work well. You know, and we can talk about whether it's communication, whether it's, you know, something else, but you know, being authentic and being direct, I think it's extremely important, and you know, knowing how to connect with players and especially with the leaders on the team, I think it's something that, and you know better than me, I mean, it's very important for coaches, because, you know, you're going to go as far as your leaders on the team push you together with the coach. You know, if you have a leader of the team that is supposed to be a leader, but he's dragging behind, like the whole team is going to be slacking, right? But if you have a leader, whether he's being yelled at or not, I'm not talking about that, but if you have a leader that he connects with the coach and you see that your leader on the team, whether it's a captain or a veteran or the best player, whatever it is, he trusts and he believes the coach and that thing is working and it's functioning, then everybody's going to fall in line and follow, you know? So that's just from my different experiences that I had when, you know, the coach and the main player on the team would show true leadership and how important that was. And that was, for example, when I was with the Nets and Jason Kidd and Lawrence Frank had a pretty quiet relationship where they were not super communicated with each other, but they had this trust and Jason Kidd would follow what Lawrence Frank said and we all fell in line and that was it, you know. And on the other hand, there were situations where, you know, I'm not going to talk about names, but the leadership would fall apart between the coach and the top player. And those things did not end well because then the coach has to deal with all the personalities. Everybody now wants his 5 minutes and becomes a problem, you know.
That was going to be my follow-up question because of that. You basically answered it because if the leader does not, I mean, you give the coach so many chances and you really try to incorporate everything, all the ideas. But if you see and you yourself as a star player don't believe in it, the player is going to sniff that out as well. And you can't follow somebody who doesn't believe in it, right? So I think it's a trickle-down effect. And then the coach just picks up the pieces or he feels that it's not going to work. And it's dead end.
I agree. And one aspect that I think is important to that is setting goals. You know, I think especially between coach and the top player, top two, three players, like it's so important to say, okay, we're going into this season and these are our goals. And that's what we try to achieve. And then I think everybody kind of follows that goal and is trying to reach that goal. Whereas I've been on some teams that we didn't know what we actually expected of us. Like, what are we trying to achieve here? Like, you know, are we trying to win the championship? Are we trying to just participate? Should we just make the playoffs and that's enough? And that was always ended up in disaster because it was kind of like just headless chickens running around and everybody. And then it becomes a situation where everybody tries to get his, right? Like, I want to get mine. And I've been in situations like this and that's not good. And it's not enjoyable for a player either.
Yeah, there's no purpose to the season at the end, right?
And that's not what you want. You know, it's the worst you can be is going to practices and playing games, but not knowing what you're actually trying to achieve. Sure, win. Yes, everybody wants to win. But basketball season is composed of small steps, practices, then wins, and then the major goal. And I think whatever that goal is, you know, staying in the first division, making the playoffs, you know, making to the finals, winning the championship, I think the team, the club needs to recognize that. The goal needs to be realistic and it needs to be like a religion. Like, that's what we want to do and that's what we work for every day. Without the goal, it's like you're just going to work and it's like just another day. And that's not good. The experiences I have with those situations were only negative.
Yeah, you have to also, like you said, set goals, but you have to give the feeling out that you're building towards something. You know, you're building something. And I like to say, there's this expression that you don't want to feel, your workers shouldn't feel like they're laying bricks. They should feel like they're building a cathedral. Like you're not just laying bricks every day, but you actually want to see the big picture. Like, this is going to be a cathedral when it's all said and done. And I'll be a part of this, you know, this is what everybody wants.
No, you put it perfectly. I totally agree.
I forgot who did the quote, so I can't shout out to them, but somebody else did this quote. One more question about coaching and then we'll move on to retirement. But what do you think are the most important traits of an assistant coach that you look for, that you feel like this assistant coach is really next level? What would you say, pinpoint, that stands out to you the most?
You know, from my experiences, I mean, you know, and you know, I mean, the coach, the assistant coaches are always kind of a link between the head coach and the players. You know, what you don't want, or I will start with what you want. Like, what my experiences are and what I always liked with assistant coaches is that they are analytical, that they can give you more information than the coach can, because they can, you know, I don't know how different coaching staffs work, but, you know, I had situations where we had two or three assistant coaches and those guys would then kind of split in groups, you know, maybe some guy had big guys and wings and guards and stuff. And it was always like, you always want, especially after games or in preparation of games, go to these guys to get more information. For me, that was very helpful. I was big on preparation always. So for me, it was very important to understand what I need to do, what my opponent might do and things like this. That's what I was looking always in assistant coaches. What I didn't like with assistant coaches was that if I lost trust in them, meaning that I would go with them in a certain problem or a certain issue, and talked to them, even confidentially if it had to be. And then I either found out or I heard or it was obvious that that got related to the coach, and it backfired to me. And it wasn't about speaking back to a coach, but it was about some insecurities that I might have about certain play we did, or about opponents or whatever, or about the tactical preparation for, you know, and just kind of try to figure out if there's something we could change and we could do. And then I would see that that would backfire because it would say, ah, you know, we have some players complaining about this and that. I was like, it's not about that. It's about trying to find the best way to work as a team and work individually. So, you know, I think the assistant coaches have a very important role because they are linked between the players and the coaches, but they also need to keep that trust level extremely high. I think it's extremely important, and that's where these coaches can benefit. And that's why you see in a lot of situations where assistant coaches are so popular that at some point, mostly with the same team, then they become the head coach because the trust level was built early and it was sustained throughout the young assistant coach's career.
Yeah, you broke it down excellent. I think that, and I've seen both. I've seen, like you said, like there, and there's two paths for two avenues for an assistant coach to have and to take and to be fluent in. One of them is the analytical and the tactical side. Like you have to know your stuff. And basically, a robot can do that stuff as well. Like you just have to know, you have to have watched enough games, clips, and break down. You know the opponent. You know the individual's weaknesses, and you can prepare each player for that. The second avenue is a little bit more complicated because that's the personal side. Mm-hmm. And that's when you also, like the players, like the head coach is a little bit further out. So he's not always there. And the assistant coaches are always the ones that are the players seek out during after practices or whatever. And you have to have a filter for that. You have to have a feel, but you have to have a filter of which information now do I need to keep to myself? How do I filter by protecting the player's information, but still filter out and portray it to the coach as like a problem that could arise in a certain manner if we don't do this and that. But by protecting the identity of the player, but also by protecting the withholding the information. So it's a way of relaying, because that information that you give to the assistant coach is probably essential for the team's success. But then the assistant coach has to think of how do I translate this and protect both sides, basically.
Yeah,
you know, and that's a riddle for a lot of coaches, assistant coach, because you have to have not only emotional intelligence but also feel for the person. You know, just having to grasp the significance of the information you just received.
Oh, for sure, and. A lot of times, you know, we see assistant coaches as firemen, you know, putting down fires, you know, like trying to keep that smooth sailing going, you know, because, you know, they are trying to protect the coach. I assume I never was an assistant coach, but part of your job description, even though not officially, is trying to protect the coach, but also, you know, understanding players and trying to relay the right information in both ways. Sometimes coaches, head coaches, because of their position, they cannot really reach the player because they don't have that bond. Complete bond, but assistant coaches do, and that's why their role is extremely important. And I think over the years I've seen that the assistant coach's role also in Europe, the importance of it has increased, whereas NBA has always been, well, when I say always, I mean since my experiences 20 years ago or 15 years ago, has been really high on having assistant coaches approach players more and building that bond.
Yep, and I witnessed that with Quinn Snyder when he was in Moscow, like that, how he approach, especially the American players, you found ways and just expressing your ideas, but also understanding the player, what the player is thinking at that moment. And then you kind of build a, with each player different, you connect different to, for example, it was like Sonny Weems and Teodosic on the same team. So you connect with both of them differently, but as an assistant, you have to find out of what makes you click and how you get on that, but you have to have also knowledge, because players respect knowledge. So if you don't have the knowledge of the game, there's only one that certain level you can go to.
Absolutely. Fully agree.
So retirement. And I talked that to Kyle, to Sammy, to JR, to Nikos. It's a little bit of I think you had a clean break. You were 37?
I was 37, yeah. I could still play. I mean, yeah, I physically felt I could still play longer. I had a calf injury in the last part of my last season that was kind of dragging out, and I could never really return back on the court. But otherwise, I mean, but it was an injury that could get healed, just needed a little bit more time. But I felt I could still play. I was still in good enough shape and still was you know, playing still in ACB and was putting up good numbers and all that. I just didn't, the desire just wasn't there anymore. You know, I, my kids were growing up and I wanted to be around more, and just wasn't, once I was not on the championship teams anymore, to be honest, because I was lucky enough in my career to always be in teams that were, you know, trying to win something, you know, and my experience in Seville at the end to just play to remain in the first division was, the motivation to just to do that wasn't there anymore. I just didn't feel the need or the desire to continue.
So it was a, basically a priority shift. You were trying to build a championship with your family.
There you go. That became, I mean, that was always most important, but at that point it was where my time is spent.
Yeah.
And that became much more important for me, that to step away and do something else but not be tied up with the strict schedule that you have as far as practices, games, travels, and all that, you know.
For sure. So the thing that I always noticed, and I noticed it because I was early with injuries, I had to finish, but that's like the identity shift you have, because there's such a long identity as a player. Is there something you anticipated that happened that you maybe couldn't foresee? Or something that you like preparing yourself for this different identity?
You know,
afterwards,
in a way, it helped me because I went from FC Barcelona, you know, let's say the final four level team, to Seville, which was one of the bottom teams in the ACB, with unfortunately a much smaller fan base and fan following, at least at that time, because the team wasn't as good as, you know, a long time ago. So it was kind of a transition from this big club of, you know, high pressure, you know, full arenas, you know, to kind of the lower level of the ACB. And it kind of, I already knew that it's going to be a big shift, that it's good. I know that people will just not be all over you anymore like you were when you player, and new generations of fans come in and they don't recognize as much. So this identity shift, I kind of expected it, and honestly didn't make a big deal out of it. I knew it's a reality, it's something that happens. And for me, it wasn't that big of a shock, just because I mentally prepared for it. I knew it's a part of life and a part of a cycle of a professional athlete. So didn't have too many issues with it. I've seen other players struggle with it, especially if you're finishing up with, you know, at such a high level that you always play and then it stops one day and you don't really mentally prepare for it, and can be a pretty hard hit. Honestly, I did, let's say, mentally prepare, even though I didn't do no special courses about it or anything, but I kind of knew that it's going to happen. So I shifted my focus into other things, like finished up my studies and got a bachelor degree, and I really started studying
in what? Business
leadership. Mm-hmm. in Newcastle. It was long distance learning that I did. So it was a mix of both. Actually, through FIBA program. It's I started with a FIBA timeout program, which was dedicated to retired or almost retired basketball players to pick up on the studies, and I was invited to be a part of it and jumped on it right away. And it was a 1 year course that we did with FIBA, and then if you wanted to continue on your own, you could continue for 2 more years, and I did. Mm-hmm. And so I got my bachelor's degree in that. At the same time, I started really, you know, taking courses and studying the NBA model and the CBA and all that stuff, because it was always my, and it still is, my desire to work in front office one day, you know, and maybe I'll pursue that at a later stage.
Yep.
So I kind of got ready for all of that, and that took my focus away from just sitting at home and doing nothing and feeling sorry for myself for not playing basketball anymore, you know? So I knew that I just have to keep busy. And the way I am, I don't know, I cannot relax. I always tend to keep busy somehow. So that's why that shift wasn't too bad. I think it's so important for players to prepare and to start preparing early, because like you said, from your experiences, careers can end up much earlier than you think they will. And you need to have something in your back pocket that you're going to go to. I think the worst and the most dangerous thing for players is to stop playing at whatever stage, especially later in the career, and not have anything that interests you or that, you know, you dedicate your time to. And that's where I see some players struggle when I meet them, you know, the players that my generation are older. And it's kind of sad to see those players who really don't have any goals anymore in life and don't know really what to do. And some are financially set, the others are not. But it's not good to see still young people, but without goals and ambitions.
Yeah, and that's it's a good segue to the ELPA, because that's a question that I would also think of pursuing with your current role in terms of preparing guys for retirement, if there's any kind of progress, but also to get back on that with the struggles that some ex-players have of not finding purpose, not having purpose anymore. Because I've read it, this is like not like super, I'm not super scientific, but men, and Jordan Peterson talked about it, like men need purpose in their life. Like there's only, how long are you going to sit on the beach? A week, exactly. 2 weeks, like exactly. A month, like you're going to go crazy. Like you can pretend, you can lie to yourself that, oh, I'm having a good time drinking cocktails and I don't have, but you will feel useless. And I feel like that's, I can relate to you where I can't sit still. And I'm sure like I would drive my girlfriend crazy if we lived together the whole time, because I was just looking for things to do because I just cannot do nothing. So I think that everybody's different in some regard, more or less on the spectrum, but there's still like if we lack purpose, we're not happy. And if we're not happy, then you really like you can drift in the wrong direction. I think it's important to prepare players for that. So I'm wondering if the ELPA has any sort of like talks, discussions with players that are going towards retirement to prepare them for that next step and give them avenues to explore.
Yeah, we started really early on. I mean, we're only now in our fourth season, basically, so we're still a very young organization. But one of the let's say the pillars or one of the things that we focused on is the retirement or things that players can do after career. And we've done periodically seminars that talked about that, among other things. You know, what to do after career and how important it is to find the things that push you forward and that draw your interest besides basketball. And we had experts coming in and talking about this. Then we have a so-called well-being program, which is run by a sports psychologist, Mar Rovira, that is an individual base with players, that players can go to her and talk about any kind of issues they have. And it's a lot connected about how to fill up the free time and how to find things that interest you. And then the third thing is our collaboration with the MBPA. So a part of our activities is also giving our members opportunity to go to MBPA seminars. You know, we have an agreement that a couple of slots are let's say open for our guys, and they've used them in the past, pre-pandemic, of course. Now we're picking up these talks again as they are picking up their programs, and most of them, if not all of them, are all meant for, you know, second careers, whether it's a front office seminar they do, whether it's coaching seminar, real estate seminar, business seminar. It's about the second careers and where your interest is and learn about it. Because it's easy to say, well, find the interest or find something that interests you. But what is that? So it's important, I think, that players have these avenues of getting into many different things without financially sacrificing anything. Like learn about it. See if, I don't know, restaurant business is for you. Do you actually enjoy it? Do you know what it means, what it takes? You know, real estate, you know, tech seminar, coaching. Do you really want to be a coach? Like, do you know what it takes to be a coach? Yeah, you know, it's great to watch, you know, all big NBA yearly coaches on the sideline, you know, calling plays and making, you know, and winning games. But do you understand what actually it means, you know? So,
yeah. So you have programs like this, and there's older players obviously that have to prepare for this. But what do you see the role of younger players at the ELPA? Like, what impact can the younger players have going forward? Because you guys achieved already certain steps that you can also talk about that are early adapting and early achieving, and the players didn't even realize that. You told me in Belgrade. So what role and what significance do the young players have in the union like this?
Well, the first thing for us is explaining actually the players what we do and who we are. It's kind of like when I went to the NBA, when I had the first Players Association meetings, I didn't differentiate NBA and MBPA. Like, I didn't know what it was all about. So I think the first important thing is educating the players, the reason why the association, Players Association exists, and what benefits it can bring to the player. And then in connection with that, one of the first things that we try to do is prepare young players for, you know, their life as a professional. And that's a part of what we do during the Final Four and ANGT tournament, is talk to young between the junior basketball to the pros. And learn, you know, and teach them about the traps and the benefits and the negatives and so on about that transition, which is not always easy. Mm-hmm. So I think as we grow as an association, I think it's going to be very important that the young players coming in start to understand what we do and who we are and how we benefit the players, because the previous generation didn't have that. So we had to go, when ELPA was founded, through the first season or two seasons, really explaining to players what, for those players that didn't understand it fully, like what we do. And they're still, let's say, we're still in these growing pains with some players who don't fully understand it, because the culture of associations is not as big in Europe or pretty much non-existent in many countries compared to the USA and American sports. But the benefits are definitely there, and having players having their own voice within any competition is, I think, extremely undervalued and extremely important. And I think in Europe, for too long, that's been, you know, neglected, and it has kind of been pushed aside. I mean, the main protagonist not to have a voice kind of sounds strange, right? Like,
yeah,
the main guys, but you don't have nothing to say how anything functions within the league. These two things don't really go together.
It's counterintuitive. Like, it should be. Is it fair to say that most players don't realize how powerful their voice is?
That's a great point. You know, I think that players don't really, on an individual level, I would say some do, or maybe even many do, you know, their own thing that they do, and the recognition they have when they try to do a business or walk into a restaurant and this and that. Like, you know, I'm the Barca player, I'm Madrid player, I'm, you know, this. But collectively, I don't think all players fully understand yet how much it can be achieved and how much it can be improved. And that's something that early on, when we started making these improvements and changes in EuroLeague, the players started realizing, you know, that together we can do more, and the players can have better standards, better conditions, more rights, better protections, and so on and so on. And that's something that the players, on one hand, didn't understand early on and didn't believe it can be done, just because the culture was so different. Like, clubs are the predominant entities,
yeah,
and players, as you know, as a player, you don't really have much to say, right? You do whatever the club does and the league does. That's it, and that's
club and coach. Club and coach are
exactly
the controlling factors,
and that's something that changed. And it's not about, you know, and we're still having this problems with some teams in EuroLeague who see us as a threat, some clubs, you know, and it's not about that at all. And that's something that we want to have these conversations to make them realize it's not about going against the league and going against the club and trying to mess everything up just so the players can be on top. Sure, we want to protect the players and help the players, but it's about growing the league and growing the competition, whatever the competition is, whether it's EuroLeague or down the line, whether it's going to change or grow or, you know, evolve. But it's about helping collectively to make it a better product. That's just as important, because the better the product is, the more successful the league is, financially and otherwise, the more benefits the players are going to have if they work collectively. And that's where we're coming from. And that's the disconnect that we see still with some clubs in the league.
And the fans receive a better product too. I mean, everybody, it's better. Like, the coach,
it's a win-win. It's a win-win.
Yeah,
at the end.
It's a win-win. Obviously, the achievements I think that you guys had are individual rooms, right? Then the practice schedule. Was the practice schedule somehow? After games, recovery after games.
There's many different rules that we were able to put down. A lot of it we copied from the NBA CBA. I mean, in regards to the players, I mean, to the practice rules, is there's shorter training camp now. It's 5 weeks max before the first official game. It used to be unlimited, as you know. You know, it used to be this two or two and a half long training camps or preseasons
in the forest running.
Exactly, running in the, you know, I'm not going to go into those stories, but but yeah, that's in the past, you know. But you know, when it comes to practice rules, yes, I mean, one practice a day, it's not so much about trying to limit the clubs and the coaches. It's not. It's about building that trust. Like, why? Let's find the balance. What makes most sense? What is actually better for the players, which is then also better for the club? What's that balance that we can find? It's not about, okay, now Elpa is trying to limit the coaches to work.
Yeah.
Not true. Not the point. Not the point of it. You know, how can we protect the players' health? How can we prolong the careers? And how can be the balance between what the coaches feel they need and what the players feel they need? And where can we find each other? But in connection to that, I mean, the improvements we added are, it's a long list, you know. So it's not just single rooms. It's remove stickers from the court and second medic.
The one I wanted. That was my next topic. Stickers are on the court. Go.
Yeah.
Keep going.
No, it's. We felt that was extremely important. That was actually one of our first, I wouldn't say demands, because it's not like we knocked on the EuroLeague's door and say we demand something. It was about, again, about recognizing the issue.
It's noticeable.
It's about, why do we feel that the stickers should be gone from the court? We understand it's a financial benefit for the club. I understand that, but how can we improve it? Let's then paint the free throw circle, the mid circle. let's do more circles, let's do more around the four lines.
Yeah.
More advertising. Let's focus more on digital advertising. Like we'll have players do more appearances if they have to. Like let's find ways to clean the court so we don't have injuries, which even this season happened in some of the domestic leagues. And the logic behind it, I think it's very simple. Like if you have a player, a special player that you pay a lot of money for as a club, are you really willing to put him, quote unquote, on ice every game and risk an injury? Because then you have to pay this player and you have to pay the new one you're going to bring in. It's a double issue, right? And this conversation started early on. And after, I think, a season or two of ELPA existing, we were already made an agreement to remove that. And then, you know, second medical opinion is a standard now in your league. You know, in our time, you could not really ask for a second medical opinion. If you did, you had to do it kind of behind the club's back, and then the club would get pissed off, and then it would become an issue. Now it's a standard thing. Overdue payment system. If salaries are late, we report to the league. There's a system behind it, how to protect the salaries and get the salaries sooner, and so on and so on. You know, the list is very long, but you know, there's definitely a lot of things we did early on, but we still want to go further and introduce the league-wide insurance for players. And down the line, my big goal for players is pension. That's also something that hopefully the league is going to be financially healthy enough in the future to accept that as a part of the deal. And that's going to elevate, you know, EuroLeague. You know, it's going to separate EuroLeague even more, not just within basketball, but within other sports as well.
Yeah, and that's
so again, talking about the benefit for the league. If you have a sports league that takes care of the players and is giving the players all these benefits, players perform better, the product overall is better, and the image of the league grows. Instead of, you know, a league where everybody knows that the players are being kind of much, you know, treated badly and so on and so on. You don't want to be a part of that as a fan, as a sponsor, whatever. So this is all the things we're trying to do to elevate the league and to help the clubs also, you know, from the player side.
Yeah, it has to be a fair play issue, right? They have to find like common denominators to agree upon, so yeah. So both parties don't feel like they're. It has to be. I don't know if it can be ever 50-50, but it has to be some give and take. Then you give up some practice time,
It is, and a lot of times we have situations and players call us and say, "Hey, but you know, our coach had a super long practice," you know, blah, blah, blah. And I say, you guys lost a couple in a row. And of course, coach needs his time to change things, to add things, to, at the end of the day, show who's the boss, whatever. We're trying to tell him, please try to be patient. If this repeats, then of course, we'll make it a bigger deal and we'll go through the league to regulate this. But sometimes it's about finding this balance and understanding what situation you're in and not to demand too much as a player. And a lot of times when you achieve something, there had to be a give and take. So it was always about getting what's more important to players and maybe giving back to the club something that is important for the club, but not as important for the player. So it's about these trade-offs. And at the end, you know, it's about me or players getting more and clubs getting more. And that's how you elevate the standards of the league, you know?
Perfect. Yeah, it's also, you know, when you practice as a player, you don't realize what the coach is thinking, how much the coach is feeling. And especially with the schedule these days, it's so hard to implement everything you want to implement in the practices because the practice times and the practice days are less and less. So the question becomes, where is the limit, right? Where do you draw the line? And do you think that going forward, and like I just hear rumors about the systematic shifts that are about to happen, but do you think there's a world that we can find at some point where the calendar will be fixed and that we can have a healthy calendar for all players to be happy with the practice time and the coaches to be happy with the practice time and the games to be balanced out and not to have so many games? I think Barcelona played like 17 games in 34 days, I think at one point it's 36, yeah. Something like that. I mean, it was crazy. So that needs to be,
especially with COVID and postponements that happened, you know, that became even bigger burden for players, you know, yeah. And then they had to really compact the games in a very tight schedule. But you know, I think that the things it's been a very difficult season within EuroLeague, you know, politically speaking. I mean, the EuroLeague has many issues, you know, clubs management and the battles inside of it. One of them is scheduling and then FIBA agreement on you know, national team games and stuff like that. My personal opinion is that I think it's going to get worse before it gets better, and worse in the sense that it's going to be even more issues that are going to be internal and more power struggles. But I do hope that this worse comes now and it gets through the summer, and then in the next season we can go into a direction of fixing things up. You know, I think that the way situation has been in EuroLeague over the past 10 or 12 months is not sustainable. The league needs to get a clear leader and clear leadership, whoever that is, same management or different management. And at the end of the day, from the player's perspective, if I put myself completely out of the picture, is it doesn't matter. You know, the league needs a clear path, a clear plan, like we spoke about earlier, you know, having a plan and knowing the direction, then it's easier to follow. But I do think, you know, that within a certain time frame, in I would say the midterm, you know, in a couple of seasons, I would hope there would be an agreement on scheduling with FIBA and regulating this better, because right now it feels like everybody's pulling in their own direction and the players are in the middle. And you have those guys who want to play for national team, but they can't, and they would like to play for national team, but on an ideal schedule when they don't have to be focusing on the club's competition and so on and so on. So the players are being, I sometimes say in a joking way, but it's kind of true. It's kind of like they're a kid to a parents that are divorced. You know, it's like one arm here, one arm here, and both are like pulling you. And, you know, the worst thing is putting pressure on the players and saying, hey, what do you want? Well, it's not no clear answer. The player wants to respect his contract and play for the club because that's where he earns the money. But he also wants to play for national team. And ideally, these two sides need to sit down, come to an agreement, come to scheduling with the players having a seat at the table or having their say. And if those three sides, you know, FIBA, EuroLeague, the players, at the end of the day, make an agreement that all agree to, the product is going to be a win-win-win for everybody.
Yes, we're all hoping for a unified European cathedral. If I may go back to my metaphor, that's the cathedral we're all hoping for, and we're building, and we're hoping that it comes together, because it's really the most fun league to watch day to day in terms of like competition. You know, the competitiveness that you feel in EuroLeague is second to none. Like you don't see the intensity at the NBA every, you know, game in, game out. And forgive me for saying that, but it is that's, you know, like the EuroLeague model in terms of competitive nature, the significance of each game is just so much higher, and you can sense it. So I'm glad you mentioned also the stickers on the court, because they contribute to a lot of injuries that drops in quality. Mm-hmm. And I hope that they can somehow fix the digital advertisement somehow to add more tools to that.
That needs to improve, and I believe it will as the technology improves. I think they're going to start doing more of these things. You know, now everything is so digitalized. You know, and I think that's where the future opportunities lie for sponsors to be seen even more, but without endangering players. You know, mm-hmm. that's for too long. That's been, you know, and we also because we didn't have the digital progress in the last couple of decades, it was, and you played, you know, games I played some games that the court was more stickers than the wooden floor, you know, yeah. Like, what are we doing here? It's been bad, but it's been improving. And the happiest I am to see that some other leagues and competitions are copying of what we do, meaning the cleaning up the court. You know, mostly the EuroCup teams, they started doing that without us asking for it in EuroCup, but they start doing it. And it's so great to see. They were not, there was not obligatory for them to do that, but they started doing it. So our hope is that it's like a pyramid system. If your league is on top, then the improvements we make are going to trickle down to other leagues and competitions, also on domestic level, because they are beneficial for the product at the end of the day.
ELPA as influencers, huh?
I never envisioned it like this, but if it happens, then yes, I like to see, because at the end of the day, sure, we're focusing on EuroLeague players, but me as a former player, like I always like to see any player having better opportunities to perform and to play and to extend their careers. And we had some really good conversation with domestic player associations and what we've done, and tried to explain them how we do things and learn from each other. And I think this cooperation is so important. You know, not everybody sees always eye to eye, and there's still some people who see ELPA as as too much of a disturbing factor, you know, that we stepped in and we just try to take over, and I don't know what. The people that know us and that they get to know us, we see that we're all about collaborating. It's all about working together, because at the end of the day, if you look at it from a very basic perspective, it's sports, it's basketball, and we all love the same thing here, right? So let's grow this thing together.
Love it. You ready for my ATOs?
Sure.
All right, I'm gonna go through this. Oh, before we start the ATOs, I played on courts that, first of all, didn't have parquet floors, but they had more non-basketball lines than basketball lines. That was
That's confusing. That's confusing for sure.
Especially when you watch tape afterwards. Yeah. Like, where is it?
That's Me too. I've been there.
All right. So I'm gonna have a couple just quick hitters for you, ATOs that you with your range can probably handle. So one thing not to do on game day.
I'm not going to say, you know, drink and all that stuff. It's kind of obvious, but I will say something in connection to nutrition. Like to me, it was not, don't overeat, you know, like I happened to be probably a couple of times that I would have a too big of a meal before the game and it never turned out good. Like I tried to be professional about it. Like that was, to me, was big one, you know,
How close to the game?
Well, sometimes you can even have like a heavy lunch, you know, it was like, you know, sometimes you had like a late game, but you would have like lunch 1 o'clock and you say, okay, I have a big meal, but then it can kind of get stuck in your stomach. You know, I was always very, on the game days, I was very careful and selective on how much I ate and what I ate and stuff like that. So, you know, I would say this, it's not a comfortable feeling when you go play a game with like a bloated stomach, you know.
Had that before too.
Yeah.
One thing you must do on game day.
For me, well, I will say two things. For me, it was take a nap, unless the game was at like 12:30, the ACB game, you know, or NBA early Sundays. It was mandatory to take a nap, and I always, for some reason, slept good, or almost always. It was like a routine that I had. But I was more than this. I would say, you know, last minute preparations. It's very important to focus on what's coming. You know, to me, it was always about this. Hour and a half before the game, go through game plan, go through individual stats, go through individual tendencies of the opponents, like get that in your mind. You know, that was a must for me always. Don't just go and say, I'll just play today and go with the flow. Like prepare, you know.
One book that impacted your life or career?
Oh, wow. That's a tough one. I read many, many. That's a tough one. I mean, I would have to say that it would probably be, and that's going to sound maybe more of like a Hollywood cliche, but I really like the Band of Brothers, Stephen Ambrose, I think he wrote it, if I'm not mistaken. It was a book, you know, that the series came out later.
Yeah.
Because I'm big on history and things like this, you know, in connection to sports. I like The Cap. It's called The Cap, and it's about how NBA instituted salary cap and how these big changes came over the revenue split and everything in the 70s and 80s. So I really recommend that for all the people who are interested in the basketball business. It's a book that came out a couple of years ago. I don't know the author, but
I'll find it.
The Cap. It's an amazing book, and it's like one of the, you know, highly regarded basketball books. Super recommended. Really, it's a history about the NBA, about the player association, about the league, about the David Stern, the struggles they had early on, and how they made it a successful business. So for people in front offices, fully recommended.
Change the NBA. Yeah, I'll link that to the show in the show notes below. One moment you would like to have back as a player?
Playing for the New Jersey Nets in general. It was a great time. Loved playing there. Had a great team, you know, playing alongside Jason Kidd and Vince Carter was probably the most enjoyable time for me. So I would take that back in a heartbeat, you know, a playoff series or something like this, you know. That was fun. That was fun.
Hardest thing you had to overcome to get to where you are now?
Probably I would say two things. My second year in Italy my first year in Italy was very difficult when I went there as a young foreign player, and I didn't play much, and I was at the time to be, you know, next year was my draft. So if I didn't overcome that small role and not playing and really dug in hard and really, you know, busted my ass for those 12, 14 months, like really worked hard to get my minutes and to start playing, I probably wouldn't be where I am. And on the other hand, you know, some injuries that I had, you know, I had never had a severe injury where I would be, you know, like a knee or a back or something, but I did have hand injury, hernia, and ankle surgery, and all of them took a while to get back. And the injuries are the toughest thing, really. It tests your character in a lot of ways.
It tests your patience and recovery.
Yeah, I think people underestimate when athletes get hurt how much that takes, and it's not just the physical damage you get, but also the the mental aspect of it, and to go through it and to come back and to get the confidence back, especially the heart injuries. It's really a test of your personality.
Best non-basketball Twitter follow?
Who do I like to follow the most? I used to be Joe Rogan, but now he's like more on Instagram and stuff like that. I like to follow him like early on. Elon Musk is kind of fun, I think, with what he does and what he's trying to do, and people try to understand him or not understand him, whatever. But he's kind of fun, especially now with him trying to purchase Twitter and see what kind of changes he brings. So maybe yeah. Him, yeah.
Yeah, he just said lately had a tweet about Lithuania as well to support the Bayraktar purchase initiative that Lithuania started. He threatened to buy TikTok, Facebook, and Instagram, I think, if nobody contributes. So contribute to that.
Yeah, he's a kid. And I'm not a super like Elon Musk fan or anything. Even though I do like Tesla cars, I have to say. But he's interesting on Twitter. Every time he tweets, it's something funny, I think, and something interesting. So,
best daily life hack or number one daily life hack that you have?
Daily life hack, yoga probably. You know, I don't do it as much as I need to get back into the routine. I used to be very disciplined about it, now lately less, but it's something I discovered after my career, but I wish I did sooner. I think yoga, I think there's a place for yoga in basketball. It shouldn't be overdone, but it can be a part of the recovery routine. I think that's something that I wish I knew sooner. I think there's a lot of benefits in that, and I enjoy doing it.
Favorite failure?
Favorite failure?
Yeah, this is Tim Ferriss' question. Favorite failure that you really look back on that helped you and you at that time maybe didn't appreciate as much as you do now?
Oh, wow, that's a tough one. Favorite failure? I failed as a musician, to be honest. When I was a
which,
kid...
Which instrument?
When I was a kid, I played the piano or the synthesizer. So I was in a rock band, and then because we went more into a rock, the guys in the band were, and I was a kid, I was 12, 13 at the time, you know, and everybody was like, well, we got to switch now from synthesizer to, we needed a bass, you know, so the bass guitar in the band. So I started learning or started taking guitar classes for a year. But I was already focused on basketball so much, so it was kind of lagging behind. Everybody was like serious musician. We had a drummer and two guitar players, and I was kind of like lagging behind. And at some point, I was like, that's not for me anymore, and I kind of felt I failed, you know, in this music world, even though I still enjoy music a lot, and I've always been a fan of good music. But that was the failure that I think put me more on the basketball path at the end of the day.
That's okay. That's okay. Yeah. We appreciate that. We appreciate that failure. Yeah. All right, Boki, that was it. You survived the ATOs and my podcast. I hope you enjoyed it.
Awesome. It was a great conversation.
I really enjoyed it too. It was really, really insightful. And tell people how they can find you if they want to follow you. I don't know how active you are, but if people want to follow and see, keep up with you a little bit.
Yeah, I'm on Instagram, Boki Nahbar. Instagram and Twitter, but Instagram, I don't post as much. I'm not a big fan of it. I'm not the big selfie guy and all that stuff that the new generation is bringing to the social media.
Yeah.
You know, I probably have still Instagram because I follow my daughter now because she's starting her basketball career. I want to be on top of things and make sure that everything's right. So Twitter is my thing. Boki Nahbar on Twitter. And I love to engage in some conversations even on Twitter and stuff like that.
Perfect.
I'm pretty accessible. So Twitter is mostly where I'm at.
Okay. All right. Appreciate it, everybody. Give Boki a follow, and I hope to see you soon.
Yeah, likewise. Let me know when you're in Spain or in Barcelona or in Slovenia, and we'll get
together. I will. We'll get together for a nice dinner. Thank you, everybody, for listening, and hope you enjoyed it. Bye.